Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Mount Rushmore National Memorial is considered a shrine to American democracy, a bucket list vacation destination, and to some, a desecration of a sacred mountain. Well, Americans are asking challenging questions now about the people enshrined in our nation's statuary and stone. As representations of Confederate leaders are removed across the country, statues of Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt have also been called into question when they include problematic depictions of African slaves or indigenous people. As South Dakotans prepare for a fireworks celebration over Mount Rushmore, along with a presidential visit, we look once again to the mountain, the men's faces carved into it, and what Mount Rushmore means to us today as we reconsider the founding, the expansion, and the preservation of the United States in a divided time. Adding to that conversation of the moment, Congressman Dusty Johnson recently introduced legislation to protect Mount Rushmore from alteration, and Congressman Johnson joins us today. Welcome. Thanks for being here. We appreciate your time.
Of course, Lori. Thank you.
This legislation that you introduced is one of those pieces of legislation that's, trying to solve a particular problem, but also being part, more broadly of a conversation of the moment. So I'm hoping you might speak to the moment. Why is it important to talk about the memorial right now for you?
Well, I think when you look at Mount Rushmore, I mean, of course, we all realize that the four men on that mountain are not perfect. And I don't shy away from the idea that we can put those imperfections into greater context. And I actually think when you go to Mount Rushmore, they do a pretty good job of that. I mean, when you sit there in the amphitheater at night and the video plays, the very well-done video, I mean, there is time spent talking about the Black Hills and the Native peoples who were there first and that really difficult and uncomfortable history. It talks about the good things of those four leaders and some of their weaknesses. And not all that many miles away from Mount Rushmore, we have Crazy Horse, which celebrates a different aspect of that broader story. And so I love American history when it is in context, when we're showing 360 degrees of it. I think when it makes us ask tough questions. In my mind, Lori, when we start to remove, as some prominent leaders, in this state have called for, to remove Mount Rushmore, I think we're making it a lot more difficult to have those conversations in the future.
Yeah, and this is kind of why I wanted to have you on the program when I was reading through the bill that you proposed, because it is becoming, challenging for some people to even talk about those things. It's easier to fall on one side or the other, take a statue down, put a statue up, for example, than to really talk about some of those nuances. And, we know the land was taken illegally. We know the sculptor was believed in Nordic supremacy. That we're having right now in our country as far as where we came from, how we got here today, what we built it on. And I wonder if you would speak to that a little bit in the sense that the problems of some of those early efforts to memorialize certain people, we're still living with the consequences of this today. It's beyond just historic interpretation. It's about action as well.
Well, if we are only going to have statues or only have chapters in history books about perfect leaders, there would be no history. There would be no statues. So for me, a fundamental question comes down to what are we celebrating? What particular component of this person's history are we celebrating? And with some of these Confederate leaders, we are celebrating their leadership in the Confederacy. Now, that was a rebellion against the United States of America. And to the extent that we celebrate that treason, we celebrate that rebellion, that is far more problematic to me than what we celebrate with Abraham Lincoln on Mount Rushmore. I mean, clearly with Abraham Lincoln on Mount Rushmore, we are celebrating things like the Emancipation Proclamation, things like keeping this union together, things like not making the political, the political expedient, negotiation to allow slavery while holding the Union together. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was incredibly principled on these issues of race, and that's what we celebrate. And during these difficult times of racial unrest and political unrest, I think it's more important that we celebrate that rather than just try to ignore that it happened.
Yeah. Is the mountain complete? Because this legislation you're proposing as well says, you know, we can't change it at this point. Does that mean that you don't want future presidents to be carved into the mountain?
I don't want future presidents to be carved into the mountain. You know, for whatever reason, I think we view mountain sculpture as different than other types of sculpture or paintings. We would never take Mona Lisa and decide, you know, she needed an iPhone in the shot because times have changed, or add some modern actress over her shoulder. I think we acknowledge that Leonardo da Vinci did his work. And, you know, sometimes like with Mount Rushmore, where you have a team and Lincoln Borglum was a part of that team, Lincoln could continue the finishing work of the mountain. But ultimately, once the sculptor leaders were done, that mountain needs to be done. And to the extent that we add to the story to provide greater context around some of the difficult history in America, we can do that contextually as part of the museum, as part of the curative experience, and make sure that we add other things like Crazy Horse to that broader geographic environment, so we're doing a better job at telling the whole story.
You mentioned Abraham Lincoln and, you know, a divisive time, a civil war in America, and it feels like we're in a very divisive time with plenty of political rhetoric. Obviously, it's an election season as well, but beyond that, this is a tough time to sort of, you know, to be an American and have some of those conversations about what that means. Are you coming to the 4th of July celebration? As we look at this celebration, how are you kind of poised to think about American independence in 2020?
Yeah, well, I'm a big believer in American exceptionalism, and I know that viewpoint is somewhat on the wane. It is it's not the kind of thing that people seem as proud to talk about anymore. But I think this experience, this experiment has been grand. And I think when you step back and look at it over the course of the last 243 years, when I look at it, I mean, I'm even more impressed than I was 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. Not that the history of the last 10 or 20 years has been so grand, but when I look at how difficult most human history is, when I look at how authoritarian it is, when I look at how violent it is, when I look at how unfair it is, the progress that America helped to bring the broader world over that 243 years is more impressive to me. I mean, it's amazing what we've accomplished. The journey toward a more perfect union is a long ways from complete. We're only half done. But there are a lot of countries that are nowhere near that spot. And so as I'm sitting there at Mount Rushmore, I mean, I'm going to, number one, it's a celebration when a United States president comes to a state. I mean, when President Barack Obama came, even though we were the last state in the country that he visited, we still celebrated that. All of our congressional delegation, our governor, all Republicans went to Watertown to visit with the president and to honor the office coming to South Dakota. And I think you'll see that, by and large, I think you'll see that same sort of reverence and respect for the office from South Dakotans on July 3rd.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about pandemic response as we look across the country and see, you know, some states are opening up and then closing back down. We haven't heard a ton from the White House Coronavirus Task Force lately. In South Dakota, of course, the story has been slightly different. We're kind of looking at this sort of evenness of economic activity and virus activity as well, although certainly not without our own problems and our own illnesses and our own deaths. But from a big picture, we're still trying, you know, more than 100 days in to sort of figure out how to fight this virus on American soil. What happens next in Congress for moving forward, not only the economic relief, but the public health vigor that we need to solve this problem, or at least hold a line until we get a vaccine?
Yeah, and I'll start with the public health, and we know what works. Now, our compliance on that front has been less than stellar. And I think that's what we as a country need to aspire to. And we do need to be intentional about how we do that. So we're not going to shut the American economy down again now. That did not provide a particularly good return on our investment. We want to be effective in a way that, I mean, we want to be effective. And what works, I mean, if 80% of us wear masks at times when it's appropriate to do so, we reduce the rate of inflation by rate of transmission by 90%. If we do things like go to the grocery store once a week rather than go twice a week, we have a material and statistically significant impact on the R-naught, or the infection rate. If we make sure that we are smart and intentional in what kind of social gatherings we go to, that can have an impact. And as I heard Dr. Scott Gottlieb this morning, he was briefing me on these issues. He's the former head of the FDA. I mean, he really made the data-driven case that if we are personally cautious and respectful, that is the most effective way to be able to, you know, hold fatalities to as low a degree as we reasonably can. And you and I have talked before about, you know, economic pain and about how, gosh, I mean, you and I talked 3 months in a row, and every month we talked, it seemed like the economic numbers were worse than I had said on your show the month before they would be. And I think we didn't understand the virus very well in the early days, and I think we overemphasized economic reduction, and we underemphasized personal behavior.
Do you think we get that now? Because as I go out into the city of Sioux Falls, and I was talking to somebody going out into Rapid City just this morning, and we both are seeing the same things, not a lot of compliance. Do we get the message of personal responsibility and the impact that we can have by doing some of these things? Are you seeing that when you go out and about? You know, you're hearing that from your family and friends and from South Dakota voters, because it kind of seems anecdotally that we're not doing what we should.
No, we don't get a good grade on compliance. I see the same things you see. It seems like everybody so desperately wants things to be back to normal that they aren't being as personally cautious as they can be, and that is driving a lot of this substantial increase in numbers we see in the South. And now, on one hand, that's a lot of people, 20-somethings and 30-somethings, they don't fear the virus because they now know from a data-driven perspective how unlikely it is to kill them. So they're engaging, and this is true in South Dakota too, in a lot less of this kind of cautious personal behavior. And that means that the fatality rate is down quite a little bit. Even though the infections are up, our fatality rates are going to be coming down. But if we really want to get back to normal, if we really want to have an economy that doesn't have to shut bars and restaurants down again, as you're seeing so many states re-implementing those procedures, then we got to do things like wear a mask when it's appropriate to wear a mask. And the fact I used earlier of 80% of people wear a mask, the transmission's cut by 90%. Well, you and I both know, Lori, there is no way in any town in South Dakota 80% of people are wearing masks when they're in the hardware store. We got some work to do.
Are we at the point from testing or even antibody testing where we're really applying, the public health data that we have? And do we have enough tests now? I know we have more. Are we still on a trajectory to get to a certain point? Where are we at for testing and monitoring and contact tracing?
Yes, I would say in testing we're in a much, much better spot than we were at any point in the last few months. I mean, this was when the history is written about this. You know, the history will have a few different components about why we just regretfully as a world didn't tackle this like we should have. I think China's slow response and communication is going to be a big part of it. I think the worldwide, you know, inability to meet the testing challenge will be a part of it. And clearly our country, I mean, that's true for our country as well. It took us a long time to get testing squared away. I mean, I think there'll be good parts of that history as well. I mean, I think this vaccine development is incredible. I mean, the fastest we've ever gone from needing a vaccine to getting one, I think, was 4 years, I think, with mumps. I mean, we're going to have this thing within a year, and that's remarkable. I mean, we're in large-scale clinical trials with a COVID-19 vaccine today and have been for weeks. That's going to be something that it just shows again, it reminds all of us. I love art and literature, and you have to have that as a civilization, but you also need really smart people who understand science and math. That's how you can save millions of lives, and that's something worth investing in.
Yeah, I think somebody on the show said the scientists will get us past us and the artists will get us through us, and that's
right,
just a platitude, but it's sort of an interesting way to look at things. Let's talk a little bit about policing before we let you go. And obviously across the country there have been protests and responses and calls to think about police funding. In South Dakota, we've seen a lot of support for law enforcement officers. that are alongside calls for to do things differently, increased transparency, more sunshine laws, and this question about qualified immunity. So I want to talk with you about your, you know, as you've watched the protests, as you watched the killing of George Floyd, and people saying it's not just one bad actor, this is a systemic problem that we need to solve. Where do you begin with that conversation? And then I want to ask you specifically about qualified immunity and whether that is a has traction in Congress. But where do you want to start?
Well, I started with a lot of personal reflection. I mean, I didn't make a big deal of it. I didn't take, you know, cameras. I didn't tweet about it. But I went to Minneapolis. I went to the spot where George Floyd was killed. I have talked in the weeks since his death with I have lost count of how many people, you know, people of color and people in law enforcement that I've talked to. And I've done a lot of listening. And before we had big problems in this country before George Floyd's death. And so we do need to focus on policing, and that is, we have improvement to make. There are a tremendous number of good cops, but our system is not where it should be. But I also don't want us to lose the importance of the fact that this is not just about policing. It is also ultimately about housing and education and economic opportunity. And we have a ways to go. And I don't criticize people exercising their First Amendment rights peacefully, of course, but it isn't going to be a Sunday afternoon march that delivers the kind of long-term value we need. You only get that with, week in and week out, over years, the kind of sometimes very boring but incredibly important work in trying to make ourselves and our systems better. And I wrote a column a few weeks ago about some areas where I think we need to do better as a country. And I pointed out some areas that I need to personally be better, but I also mentioned that, I mean, I'm not newly waking up to this issue. I mean, in this office, I have been a champion for the investment. I've been the floor manager for a bill that invested in historically black colleges. I've been the floor manager of issues related to Native American languages. I have introduced bills that address Native American health care. I have created the Ben Reifel internship in my office that is reserved for people who care about Native issues. But listen, that's not enough, and I got a long way to go, as frankly we all do.
Talk a little bit about qualified immunity, because the United States Supreme Court has taken a pass on really bringing that into their purview of things that they need to decide in the coming days. Is that something that Governor Kristi Noem in a press conference said that she thought that should be looked at? How do you approach qualified immunity, and do you think it needs to be addressed by Congress?
Yeah, and you will. So much is tied up in the definition, and so you will have some people tell you in. And this is somewhat accurate, that if you have a police officer who is, if they are in any way breaking the law, if they're in any way breaking department practice, or if they're in any way breaking, you know, best procedures, that qualified immunity doesn't protect them. And that is true to a point. And so then you sort of get to a point, well, wait a second. I mean, none of these officers, I mean, you know, Officer Chauvin was not protected by, I mean, he would never have been protected by qualified immunity. I mean, that was not best practice. That is not in his training. The knee is supposed to be at the shoulder blades, not on the neck. So if somebody's following the law and following all the best practices and procedures, don't we think that they, you know, we shouldn't be taking away their house and their car and their pension? The difficulty is that this is Supreme Court-made law. And one of the reasons we should really bristle at the idea of the Supreme Court just showing up and making new law to govern a country is that they don't always get it right at the day that they write it. And it's hard to amend a Supreme Court decision. There is a provision that treat a fact set differently if there is, quote, a substantially similar case. And that's the part I think we do need reform of. Those who want to throw out qualified immunity altogether, I think, misunderstand the legal definition. Those who think where we're at today, I think, misunderstand the legal definition. The Supreme Court made this too muddy, too complicated, too difficult to enforce. I think Congress should act.
Before we let you go, Congressman Johnson, any final thoughts? As you know, we're willing to talk about a lot of the messiness and the difficult things, but maybe I'll just ask you this: what are you optimistic about right now, going into this 4th of July weekend? What makes you feel really positive and hopeful?
Well, you know, we talked about art earlier, Lori, but there is in the tunnels between the House and the Capitol. There is a piece of artwork from each congressional district that I didn't select for South Dakota. I mean, a panel of artists selected. And these are young artists. And we're swapping them out. We're getting a whole new round of art. The South Dakota artist who was selected, she's incredible. And the runner-up was incredible, too. And when I see this artwork, it is beautiful. It's a celebration of all kinds of different parts of American life. And as I reflected on that artwork, and as I reflected on, you know, the maybe dozen men and women that I nominated for the service academies and who were accepted, and as I talked to them on a Zoom call, young people really get it. They love this country. They're harder working than we give them credit for. They're more values-based than we give them credit for. And listen, if we can hold on to this country and this future long enough for them to come alongside us, they're better than us, they're smarter than us, they're going to deliver a new great American century if we give them the opportunity to.
Congressman Dusty Johnson, we appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Lori. Bye.